and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we're going to talk to a thriller writer. His name is Rick Mafina, and he's written a book called The Panic Zone, which I've been enjoying this week. Welcome.
Thank you.
How are you?
Thanks for having me. Not too bad.
You're in Canada, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I figured from... This book, The Panic Zone, which from the first time I saw it and heard about it, there's lots of people saying good things about it, including Dean Koontz. How did you get a blurb from Dean Koontz? That's amazing.
It just happened. I was quite fortunate to count myself very lucky for that.
He's one of my all-time favorites, Dean Koontz. I know people have different opinions about Dean Koontz. He's one of those authors that, you know, some people love him, some people have read him years ago and don't read him anymore. And what's interesting, first of all, is that it's a $9.99 paperback. I didn't realize that Harlequin did that many of these oversized, which I really like.
It's the first for me in that format, and I thought it was exciting to see how it would do. I mean, it's a little pricier, but it's a nicer format. I sort of have mixed feelings about whether people would be interested in that format, but it seems to have been appealing to a lot of readers.
Well, just reading the book, I mean, holding it in your hand, it's very, for some, very comfortable when you hold it for some reason. I think even more so than the smaller paperbacks, which tend to...
Yeah, it's got a little weight to it. I like it. It's a very attractive book. I like it.
But it's interesting. They only do it for certain authors, and I was thinking to myself, well, which authors do they pick to do that with, and how do they decide what it's going to... Marketing is a very interesting aspect of the publishing, because they seem to know everything about what they're doing.
Well, I figured my feeling on it was, I guess I was a bit of an experiment to see. I know it throws the symmetry off with people who are collecting, but that's neither here nor there. I can't control that.
Well, the question is how good the story is, and this is a really interesting story, and it's got three things going on at once, and I like how you go from story to story, and then suddenly they converge in the middle. Do you like doing that with all your books, or is this unusual
for you?
Yeah,
I do. I like that format. I think that's sort of, that can happen with any kind of story, really, but it is sort of a hallmark of certain types of thrillers. I like that. It's kind of a cinematic approach to things, and that's always appealed to me. I quite enjoy it. As long as it's like juggling, and you just don't want to drop the ball. And readers who first say it's complex, but then they said they followed through okay, that it came together okay.
Yeah, the bad characters, and I mean, of course Emma is really, and in my mind, the central part of this whole story.
I like her.
Because she's so memorable and so, you know, unyielding. This woman is not going to give up no matter what. No matter who tells her that to give up, she's just not going to give up. And it's interesting how that plays all the way through the book. And you get mad when so many people are just saying she's crazy. I mean, how your son is not alive, you know?
I worked on her. I wanted the readers to be with her. Like, the reader is on her shoulder. They're with her, and they know what she knows. I wanted them to feel what she feels, that on another world, the institutional world, it made perfect sense that this would all be a matter of post-traumatic stress, grief, everything, that it would fit naturally in the world as we know it, but in everyone's heart of hearts that there's always this slim thread of hope. And there have been the odd cases in the real world where this has happened, and I wanted to play on that and infuse that character with that kind of drive. And you know, she's already lost everything, but she truly believes that there's still something there. And then having her, I knew that ultimately she would have to meet Jack Gannon, and I wanted to build that up so that would work out.
And that's another interesting aspect of the book. When I read that was going to happen, and I'm reading the book, and I'm halfway through, and I'm thinking, well, it hasn't even happened yet. I wonder if I'm reading the right book, you know. I was a little confused, and then it suddenly, you know, it comes together. But I liked the way I kept thinking to myself, well, how are these two going to get together? How is he going to bring this all together? And that's when you read a book, you think about that. You think, well, how is all this going to come to? What's going to happen next? And all these things are going through your mind while you're enjoying the book. And that's just an interesting aspect to it. Is that, do you think about that when you're writing too? I mean, is that?
Well, a little bit, sure. I mean, you are the architect of the story and how it's going to unfold.
I mean, do you know before you start writing how it will all come together? Or
I do have a pretty good idea, and sometimes it's fun when you know you're starting them at a totally illogical points, thinking this can't be. I mean, they're not even in the same time zone. They're not even, you know, how is this all going to happen with all of this important stuff that has to happen in between? And I think it heightens the suspense and maybe heightens the tension and raises the stakes. So I like doing that sort of thing when I can. And I vary it. I mean, it's a matter of flavoring. I mean, it varies from story to story, but it's a general approach I like to take. But ultimately, I can vary from story to story. There can be a linear approach as well.
Well, varying is good, because I'm sure that makes it more challenging for you. You know, how am I going to do this?
Yeah.
What do I do next? How do I make a story believable? You can't just decide on a story and not have it believable. It's gotta make perfect sense at the end. I mean, if the reader gets confused, they're gonna close the book. They're not gonna finish the book.
I think you raise a good point there. I think there's a number of factors. I think first and foremost has to be reader empathy. I think some readers have told me in reading in general that, you know, there's that the suspension of disbelief and how much you're willing to pay for that. I mean, you know, you might go, well, this and that. We all do in the certain movies or books. Well, we didn't buy that, but the characters are so compelling, I cut you some slack there. Then there are the perfectionists who demand that every thread be right in place or the whole story will fall apart. I think it's a combination. I think first and foremost, intertwined is story and character, of course. Plot is more of the technical aspect of it all, of the entire enterprise. So I think if you build compelling characters and a good story, the plot is will hold it all together. But you do have to make sure that all the bolts are tight and they do connect. It is a challenge, and I think probably the Panic Zone is one of the more complex books I've written. Sort of like 6 seconds. In terms of a global stage.
Now, is this the first book with Jack Ann, or was there another one?
This is the second.
This is the second.
Vengeance Road.
Vengeance Road. Okay.
Yeah, which is up for Seamus this year. Was
really? That's great. Congratulations.
Yeah, was the first in the series. It introduces Gannon, and Panic Zone's the second, and in Desperation will come out in April. That'll be the third. I'm just embarking on writing the fourth in the series right now.
So you've already finished the third one?
Yeah, it's done, yeah.
Wow, that's great. And so soon, we get to read it next April. Now, is the plan to keep them in mass markets like this?
Or is certainly in mass market. I've always been a paperback original author. I've never been out in hardcover.
Do you want to be?
Well, that desire has sort of, gone, ebbed and flowed, I guess, because there's a risk when you go hardcover.
Do you get more exposure when you're hardcover, though?
You get more exposure, but if the numbers aren't there in the terms of the sales, it can also be a backlash. It depends, but I'm comfortable where I am now, and there is talk of maybe more making more of an effort going to hardcover, but there's so many forces these days with the revolution with e-readers and everything, and that the cost of bringing out hard covers, but I got a base, I guess, a reader base that I've developed with the, I'm up to about 12 books now.
Wow, very cool.
So that should help. But we'll see. I mean, I've come out in a couple of special editions, that sort of thing, Mystery Guild and that, but we'll see.
Wow, Mystery Guild, that's pretty big. That's really good. When you were thinking of the Panic Zone, I mean, where did the idea come from when you first thought of the Panic Zone? I mean, what were you doing, and how did it come to you?
Oh, it wasn't just one. There was a culmination of a number of story ideas. One is the plight of a woman like Emma. That was certainly first and foremost. In my reporting days, I had been to Africa and there's some stuff there that intrigued me. I was Ethiopia and traveling around there. So the intrigue of, parts of the world that, the West doesn't know too much about.
Now, do you make...
But it's eye-opening when you're there, of course.
Do Do you make notes when all this is happening, and do you have like a notebook there of all the
from your reporting days? No, not really. I mean, I go to my stories that I wrote at the time to get the dates right, and the things that I know that are intriguing, they're just sort of seared into you. So I'm going to use this in some way, shape, or form, or use it and build on it. I mean, it's never really word for word or anything like that, but it's just a sort of an inspirational seed. And I was in Jamaica on a story, and I got to travel around with a crime reporter, and I was traveling around with their the National Police Force, the JCF down there, the Jamaican Constabulary Force, and
cool.
They're right along with their task force, anti-drug task force. They were doing drug raids in the ghettos of Kingston.
Oh, that must have been interesting.
We were in a caravan with paramilitary cop types, you know, like SWAT team types.
Mm-hmm.
And we're about seven vehicles in the caravan, and at one point during one of the stops, out of the blue, these two white guys showed up, you know, in their 30s, dark glasses, very serious face, and they saw me, and they just said, and I'm sitting in the back of a pickup with some other police who were reloading, and they said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm a reporter," and I whipped up my notebook and said, "Who are you?" And they said, "We're not here," and they just walked away.
Huh.
And the cops beside me said, "Well, they're with the CIA. They're doing something here." And I just thought, well, okay. And that sort of stuck with me, is that, you know, we hear about it, we read about it, we see things, but just sort of a little brush up against it. There's lots of stuff going on in the world, and they didn't seem too happy that I was there, but I'd never heard anything more about it and never saw them again. And they could just walk by like ghosts. They were somewhere in the caravan. And as we found out recently with developments in Jamaica, that there's a lot of political overtones with a lot of the drug trafficking that goes on, because Jamaica is a hub into the U.S. and Europe. And so the police I knew down there told me that. So that stuck with me in terms of agents and agencies involved in all types of working connections. So a little bit of that played into the panic zone ultimately. And the same with Africa. I was with a press contingent following the Canadian Prime Minister on a multinational tour, and we traveled into the rural countryside outside of Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, and we were visiting a village, and I got nipped in the leg by a dog, and later found out that we were in a 99 or 95% exposure rate for rabies, and the doctors were freaked out because the press guys never read the notices they posted for the press pool in the hotel, and they said the little dog broke the skin, and as they were whisking me away from the five-star hotel through the slums of Addis Ababa into this clinic for diplomats, and I was being well-treated, I mean, we're in a, you know, you're in a third world country, and we're going through the, and every traffic stop, the hands came out because we had a brand new vehicle for begging for money, and that's going through your mind. And then the doctors are telling me about the risks of rabies, and I read up myself. They gave me literature about bats, and then I got thinking about the, you know, we were in Nigeria as well later, and by the equator, and I got, so all that seed was planted. Well, what if bats did this? So I did some research on some of the academic journals on certain types of bats and concerns about emerging diseases through the mosquitoes and come out of the jungles and swamps and things. And I thought, well, let's play around with that and just let my imagination run wild. But it was the core of that experience that served as another story thread for the panic zone.
That's interesting. You know, all these ideas are running through your head and they all come together for a novel, and a very interesting novel, too. I mean, I love the scenes with the bats, going in the caves with the bats. It's all I can think
fun.
Of is...
That's pure horror fun. I hate snakes, I hate caves, and bats just freak me out. And a lot of people, the same with Spider, that old theme of find people's fears. I mean, caves and bats and you know, possible diseases that can
it's amazing how, as a writer, you writers have such a huge imagination. I mean, you can think up all these things and all these situations and come out with a great story. I mean, you look at, you know, horror writers, you know, like Stephen King and things like that, all these wonderful ideas that come flowing out of him, and some of them are very sickening, you know.
Well, I think it comes back to also the old advice that's stereotypical, just read and stuff. I mean, the little trip, the scientific expedition, that was sort of my my homage to Conrad. I love Joseph Conrad and Heart of Darkness and going through the jungles and the unknown. And so a little research of, I mean, I've been to Africa, but not into those parts, not into those countries, but I still had an idea of what it was like. And I thought, I'll do some more homework and just sort of send my expedition to the darkest, remotest parts of wherever, Cameroon. And because there had been some things that developed there. There was a weird natural disaster where this lake became like poison, or it started to emit a certain type of gas. It killed everybody in the area, and it was like really with Mother Nature. And I thought, well, what if mosquitoes came? Let's play with that. Mosquitoes came from that, and they got into the bats, and you have a super bat called the pariah bat. I just made all that up, but on the foundation of truth. I was having fun with it, and I used the structure from journals kept by actual field researchers when they go off into these remote regions, either researching bats or other types of possible contagions and things like that. So there's enough of reality there, and there's enough information. Once you get going through research, you can find your pockets of reality that will hopefully hold it together. And the whole CIA and experiments, that was another thing with the Nuremberg Code, and that just intrigued me, and experimenting on people throughout history. All governments are all enterprises, really. There's always a chapter or two of things that were a bit dark. And I thought, okay, we'll buy that as a reader. I did, certainly, and let's play around with that. What if something just didn't work out for a particular scientist? And again, I wanted to make sure that Gretchen Sutsoff's background was believable to a degree.
She's nasty, that one.
Yeah, not just a bad, brilliant villain, but and I got thinking, what are some of the worst things you could, again, the fear of being trampled in a stadium and how it just can suddenly happen. So I read reports of football stadium tragedies around the world and dug up where I could the inquiry reports and summaries, how they actually happened, and get a sense of that and put a reader in that situation, how it can happen. And I mean, we've all been to concerts or big events and where it's all organized and everything's fine, but how it could possibly turn on a dime. I've been in events where the crowd did get a little tight and a little crazy and you get out of there, but how it can just turn into something horrific. And I tried to make it as horrific as it could be for her, so the reader would get that.
It's a very strange. It's a very strange.
Yeah, play on the heartstrings and all of that. Yeah.
It's very strange to be in a crowd. Speaking of crowds, I mean, anywhere you go. I mean, I've been to Star Trek conventions, and you want to see a crowd. It's like to be in this mass of people and not know what's coming next. I mean, anything could hit you, and anything can happen to you, and you don't realize at first what it's going to be like. I get this sudden panic feeling, like, what? How can I get out of this? I got to get somewhere where there aren't any people, just to be alone.
Yeah.
You know that we all know that what that feels like, you know. And I don't know. I don't really have an aversion to crowds. I don't like them completely, but if I'm there, I'm there. If it's something I want to see, I don't mind as much. But you know,
with her character too, that's why it had to be crowd to play on her larger fears of overpopulation, that it was grounded in that she'd experienced that, and her general disdain for people who she felt were largely intellectually inferior to her, it was a God complex, sure. But I wanted to play with that. I wanted the reader to understand her and find her interesting. I mean, and it's a switch. It's usually, for me, the evil person is a guy in one way, shape, or form. It was different to, you know, a brilliant woman who could be the antagonist in the book. That intrigued me, and how she outsmarted the guys and their experiments. And I did some research into the whole World War II and later the CIA stuff, how at least what we could find in the public record of philosophy behind some of the work. That if
you do a lot of research,
yeah, well, it's there in the book. So if it's all public, back in World War II, they thought if things went worse, went for the worst, and they were going to be overrun through Alaska, either by Japanese forces or then the Red Army, maybe allied with the Nazi forces, that they would bring out these weapons of chemical and biological weapons. At the time, this was before the atomic bomb was coming, but they were prepared. It was an extension of World War I research or efforts as well, with mustard gas and all of that. But just horrific stuff. And I thought, well, you know, what if there are all kinds of experiments? And there were accounts in Russia where some sort of got away from the lab and that sort of thing. Or, I mean, there's always that telltale, or something was stolen, or something
Yeah, you can do a lot of research with your books. I mean, just for this one book alone, it sounds like you did a ton of research over the years without realizing you were going to use it.
Well, you can. I mean, it doesn't... You can look it up pretty quickly and go to the library and pretty much... I mean, as a reporter, as an author or anybody, when you sort of know what it is you're looking for, you can find the stuff if you have a general idea, because there are... We do have these, preconceptions already of or understanding of history. You just dig a little deeper, but you don't want to get lost in it. Otherwise, you forget that you got to tell a story. So it is an iceberg thing. You may over research, but you only need so much to keep the story valid and keep it going.
Well, what's interesting is the bomb at the very beginning of the story. I like the way that it starts out literally with a bang. You know,
and I like that. I'd never been to Brazil. For some reason, I was just drawn because in the first book, Jack Gannon's dream was to leave his newspaper in a mid-sized city and work for a big international wire service. And that was part of my story arc, is that for the character or the reporter, he would work for a wire service, which meant he wasn't really tied to a community. And I used to work for a wire service, and I have friends who work for a wire service. And they may be based in a city, but technically, he could travel anywhere. The world could be his beat. So I wanted him to be like a Jason Bourne with a laptop or BlackBerry or something like that, and that he could go anywhere if the story was big enough. And that was acceptable. My friends at the Associated Press said, well, it doesn't happen too often, but yeah, it would work. And then the tensions would be there naturally with the Bureau people saying, well, this is our backyard. We don't need help, especially from a guy who doesn't understand anything. But his strength was that he just is a relentless meat and potatoes reporter. And then the reader can go along with him as the fish out of water, the ugly duckling type character, and he's mumbling, struggling along. So I thought, well, I could send him anywhere in the world. Where are we going to go? And I just, for some reason, I'd never been to South America, but I became intrigued with Brazil and Rio, and thought, well, let's just do it there, and then bring in all these other threads that we've worked on. I just discussed with you. I'd been to London, and the London scene is actually when I went to visit my publisher. I mean, that's where I did take notes there. I knew I was right in the midst of the panic zone. I said, well, London is going in it in the book because I'm here for the first time and loving it. So wherever I walked, I took a few notes. It's my hotel room. It's Jack Gannon's hotel room, and the parts around Kensington there where he meets his source there. I had been to Morocco, so we used that a bit.
Well, obviously, you spend a lot of time doing that, and a lot of time writing crime thrillers. Does that affect you in any way? Does it affect your mood sometimes? I mean, how do you get away from it? I mean, writing it all the time.
I try to get in the moment when I'm writing, but I mean, that was the same when I was actually covering the real thing. I mean, it's always there, and I knew, I think, when I was reporting, because I had been writing fiction before I was a reporter, that I would always use this. I always was quite philosophical about the job I was doing. I always felt, especially in the most challenging moments, which was usually dealing with the families of victims of crime or the detectives. The detectives were quite easy to deal with, but it was the families, and felt that I had a moral obligation to do my very best job. I wasn't one of the how-does-it-feel reporters. I didn't need that. I had more time to, if you want to share what thoughts are going through your mind right now, or if there's someone in the family. And usually 90% of the time people talk to us, but also I realized they were also in a period where they didn't real know up from down. They would tell me years later, some of them, if I kept in touch, and I knew they were incredibly vulnerable, and whatever the reaction was, there were a couple of you might consider rude ones, I never took it personally. I felt they were entitled to do whatever they wanted during that period. I totally carte blanche, because we were invading their privacy. We were intruding. It was the tip of the sword, I think, the point of the sword of democratic freedom in an open society, that we nobody dies anonymously in our society. Nobody, the police aren't, we refuse to give names about that mysterious death on the highway last night. I mean, and that's the price we pay. It might be a rationalization, but we kind of felt that, and to share with the community what the loss was. And I think that happens largely in most open societies, although there are some laws in certain countries about release of names and that sort of thing, depending on the crime. But I always felt dealing with that was hard. But as a friend said, that the fiction emerged for me to go back and write the happy endings to some of the stuff I'd experienced. And I thought, well, that might be might be a good analogy for it, and it might have been therapeutic, but I felt that I'd learned enough and obtained enough from my personal view. I think that's the same for anyone who's been a reporter or, you know, a paramedic or those who, in those positions that maybe write fiction, that they've experienced that and can invest their work with a bit of philosophy and a bit of realism. I don't know. You never forget that kind of thing. But then again, it comes down to storytelling. And I just work on the stories, and I'm just a boring suburban guy. Getting the stories done.
Well, you're hardly boring. Reading these books, it's hardly boring. A boring person wouldn't make these stories up.
Well, I do think that I owe the reader. I think coming back to the obligation I feel that came from crime reporting is also, I think, evolved into the page that I feel that I have. I'm in a privileged position that I'm a professional published author. That if you're going to invest your time, you have every right to demand the ultimate best, and I have every obligation to deliver my ultimate best, so that when I'm throwing it in there, I'm giving you everything I can give you in terms of my best of a story. I'm throwing in everything I can. I like something to be at stake almost with every sentence. I like high drama, high melodrama, and suspense. That's entertainment. It's escapist entertainment. And in my stories, it's a contractual, you know, an unstated contractual agreement that things will work out, justice will be served. I'm not writing downers at the end. You know, whatever moralities at play, it'll work the way it's supposed to. But I give you a full view of where I can, and not waste your time and entertaining myself. I sometimes do go off on tangents with words and oh, this is lovely, I can write this, and but I don't need it. You know, what is it I need to convey here? And I do get criticism from some readers that I'm too bare bones. They do like a little more seasoning, I guess. Like, well, can't please everybody.
No, you can't. And I mean, I like the story, and the story works. When you read it, it's just very compelling to read. Now, I'm wondering, without, we really can't talk about the ending too much, but it sort of sets up for the. Could that be setting up for the next novel?
Oh, well, in terms of.
I don't know what we can. I don't know.
Jack. Personal life?
Yes, yes.
Well, then you're right there, yes.
Okay, well, that was
purposeful, yeah.
I hoped it was, because I'm thinking if he doesn't do that next book, I'm going to be very disappointed, because you can't skip.
A lot of readers ask me that. Well, what's the next one? Is he going to go this way? And in terms of personal, you know, and that will be, in a way, a smaller stage, a little more intimate and a little more, but another world concern as well, but more how shall I put it, constrained to a certain region.
Well, I'm wondering if all these emails you get from people and all these suggestions, and they say they want more of this and more, do you ever listen to them? Do you ever do what they want?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You heed them all, I think, and then you filter it as to you know, what is a point that maybe I can actually capitalize on, or what's a point that it's nice, but you know.
And if enough people say they want this, I mean, why not give it to them if that's what they want, you know?
It depends. But as far as the one that's coming out in April, that was naturally sort of pointed to it at the end of the Panic Zone, and it's safe to say.
It would be teasing us if you didn't follow through on that. You know?
Yeah. I think if you read that little opening scene, you might get a sense of who that really is. So. But I don't want to give anything away.
Ah, I didn't realize that. Now I do. I think I know what you mean. But we have to dance all around this because I don't want to give anything away.
And I think with Vengeance Road, Panic Zone, and In Desperation, which will come out, admittedly, they all open this with the same note in terms of a woman in trouble.
Why do you think people like reading your books? I mean, what would you say if somebody said to you, "Why should I read your books? Tell me what it is about them that I'll like." What would you say?
I don't know. I think they like that the stories are compelling. This is what I get from readers, that the stories are compelling. They move real fast, which they like. They do tell me, they make a point of, they like the plain language. They like the short chapters. I like the short chapters, too. I like them basically to be almost one-purpose scenes. I mean, I do mix things up, and I have mixed up perspective in a few chapters when it's necessary. I try to stick to, you know, one point of view, one chapter. I tend to. I'd say 85% of the
And you have to remember, a lot of readers are reading late at night, too, before bed. And sometimes it's the only time they get to read. And to have short chapters, they can end the chapter and go to sleep. And
that's right. And also for the commuter reader, those on the buses, planes, trains, waiting in the airport, that, okay, I can get through this chapter. It's first boarding call. I can get through this chapter. And a sense of accomplishment. There's an editor that told me that way back, that I hadn't done that on purpose, but just you get a sense of accomplishment that you're making progress, and actually you're reading a book for pleasure, but you're progressing along as opposed to plowing through a tome that, okay, he's described this lake region where his character lives for 100 pages here. Are we going to get on with it, kind of thing?
Right.
But it's a matter of taste. It's what, I know that I'm a commercial fiction author, providing entertainment and escapism with a little bit of morality and characters that may stick with you for a little while, or something in the books that may stick with you. But they're the types of stories I like, and they evolve from my experiences. And I know they tend to be the same, and every now and then I'd like to mix it up. The standalone with 6 seconds was fun to do.
Is the plan to do 10 Jack Cannon books, or is it just...
I think the answer is unknown right now.
What would you like?
Well, I don't know. We'll see how far the series goes. This is my third. The first series went 5 books, and it's been on hiatus, and I would think it's safe to say that it retired after 5 books, but I could always resurrect it. And that was well-received for the audience I had.
But would you rather, you yourself, if you had the pick, would you rather do standalones each time, or would you rather do a series?
I'd like a mix.
You like both?
For a number of reasons. Yeah, I like, it gives you a break. But the series is good, is that it's like a visit back with friends, and reader reception is important, because they really do like them. And many times, I get emails on certain characters who are really supporting cast in some of the books, and they've asked, are you going to do a series just on these characters? I really like this character or that character. What's going to happen with them? And you should do a book on them. And not a lot, but on occasion. But I like to answer your question, I guess I like the mix. And I've only experienced it once with the first standalone, and I know I've got another one I want to do coming up. So we'll do, when I'm done this one that I'm working on, that'll be early next year, then I'll probably attempt to outline a standalone.
What's interesting is a lot of times when writers write a series of books, they always have their main character who never has any free personal time. Is it possible, now you've hinted a little bit in this book, that Jack might just have something coming up, might just have found somebody. Is that possibly going to be taken up in the next book?
Yeah, well...
Without telling who it is.
The one that's coming out in April, that'll be all wrapped around the story. So it'll be critical, the relationship he has there.
You know who I mean.
Yeah, it'll help with the overall story arc. And then in the one that will follow, that'll just be pure story. He'll just be on the story. There'll be some other aspects to it as well, but that'll be just a straight-up hardcore adventure where he's pursuing this story. And I don't know where we're going with that. There may be some hints, but he tends to be a lone wolf.
Yeah, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's bad. Sometimes I want them to find somebody. I mean, there's so much, like when you watch a TV show, anytime they fall in love with somebody, they end up dying, or something horrible happens.
Well,
it's like they can't ever have a relationship.
In my other trilogy, it was a 3-book trilogy, that worked out quite nicely. There was a relationship. It soured, but they still had to confront each other, so there was the tension they had before the relationship, and then the post-relationship tension that was there, all together in really 2 books, because that only came into play in the 2 books. And I like that. That worked out nicely. It gave an added dimension. And there was an originating relationship in that one where no deaths, but the fear of one, but more realistic, I think, were the relationships in that trilogy. That's that series is still doing well in Europe. It's been released in the backlist in the UK, and I get a lot of responses from Australia and New Zealand on that one.
That's That's great. That must be very gratifying to get all this feedback. Yeah. And people are actually, even if, you know, there's going to be a complainer in all of them. If somebody's going to write to you and say, well, I didn't like this or I didn't like that. But I mean, it's still nice to know they're reading it and analyzing it. Even if, you know, then you're not going to find a book everybody likes.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You were right there. It's gratifying. It's just when you think back to, you know, when I was just a kid and writing out in longhand and wondering when it'll ever be published, and you know, you're happy if a short story got picked up in a magazine or.
Well, you must have known you would get published sooner or later.
No, you never know. You never really know. I mean, it was for me. It was a.
Well, is it all? How much of it is confidence? How much of it is talent?
Wasn't so much confidence, David. It was. I was writing anyway. I started writing in grade school. Ever since we had to do assignments of creative little stories.
Well, weren't you determined to get published?
No, I didn't quite understand anything. I wasn't well read, not that I'm well read now, but I didn't understand literature. I didn't understand anything other than it was fun to write up a story that you could make up. As you hear many times, you could tell lies and be graded on it. And I was a very good liar and storyteller. I think I came from a family that they just told good stories about experiences, and I just was engrossed by them. And sat down and told my stories, wrote stories, and for the fiction aspect, and then in high school joined the creative writing group, which, and again, I didn't find that to help me much, so I didn't stay long. I kept it to myself and got a few little things published in local community papers, and that was gratifying. But I never understood until I picked up a magazine called The Writer just by chance, and started understanding there were markets. There's a structure to this. This is how it worked. I mean, it was out there. There are books in stores and books in libraries, but I just didn't understand how you got from your brain, a story from your brain, to a book in a store. Because I was, 15, 16, I didn't know. So I studied the magazine, almost came out of Boston back then, bought it when I could afford it, and would send my little stories off. That was the first step to magazines in the U.S., and got a couple published, and I thought, well, I better just write a book, and I tried. I did one, but it was terrible. And anyway, it took time, and then I went to university with the aim of becoming a reporter to get experience that would help my writing. That was writing beforehand.
You didn't have? Did you have any writers that kind of made you want to be more of a writer? I mean, would you read any different authors that influenced you?
I got the nickname from a kid because I was in college. He just called me Hemingway. I didn't know who Hemingway was. Like, just that he was just a name synonymous with writing, Hemingway or Dickens, right? And when you're a teenager back in those days, I don't know. So I started reading Hemingway, and because he was easy to read for someone like a teenager who was sort of distracted and not really focused, it was accessible. So I read everything, and because it was easy, then I thought, well, okay, who's this Fitzgerald guy? So I tried some Fitzgerald, which was at the time was a little more difficult, and I tried Faulkner. So I started, and then through school, I was terrible. At high school, I didn't do well in English. I was lazy. It was only when I went off to university that I was more focused and excelled in the English literature. I threw everything I had into that and did quite well on the English lit. And there was a course called American Detective Fiction. And that's when I learned what noir was, and that's when I learned who Poe was. And Poe was more than just a horror writer. His role in the pantheon of mystery writers, and understood the existential and psychological crime stuff behind Dostoevsky. And so I was growing then, and it was helping me. And at the same time, through the 4 years I studied at university, during a reading break, I picked up Strangers Watching by Mary Higgins Clark.
Oh, yeah.
And then after all of this, you know, you're focused in university, and everyone knows what it's like with, you know, the reading list, and you're reading the heavy-duty stuff, and you're getting it. I was, at least. And then to take a break like that and pick up, you know, that was like picking up candy, and it was well-written, well-structured, and I just loved it. And I thought, she made a mistake, because it's so slim, and I went back and analyzed it, and think, where did she make a mistake? You know, it's also put together. I couldn't find anyone. I kind of love that stuff. And then I picked up something by James Patterson, Virgin, way back.
That's an oldie. Yeah.
Yeah, and I loved it, too. It was similar. It's like, okay, then I started reading The Commercial Guys, 6 Days of the Condor, and Day of the Jackal, and
Frederick Forsyth,
eating that stuff up. And then I would switch, because I read university, I thought, I'll read a classic, then I'll read contemporary. I'll read a classic, and that lasted for a few years just to keep my... So I thought the long process started when I hit the crime desk. I didn't know, okay, now I've got my university degree, I've got a full-time job as a reporter. Now it's time to knuckle down and write something, and I was going to go supernatural because I liked that as well. And we were living in a remote area in Canada. I was a bureau guy for the prairies. So we lived in this little ghost of a ghost town, really. It was only 10,000 people. It was freaky and quiet. And I thought, okay, I'll set something here. And I started in longhand, and it wasn't really coming together. And then I got called to say that we need you in Calgary, which is a larger metropolitan area, and on the night cop desk, which I didn't want to do. And then when I saw my first body on the job soon after, the lights went on for me, and it was a senior cop who was on the night shift. He let me go up close. He go look at it if you want. There's no one around. A guy died in a car crash. Had rolled over off the expressway at like 2 or 3 in the morning. There's nobody there, just the cops and the night crew, and he still buckled in. And I got to know this cop because I was the only guy on the night newspaper desk to go out and, you know, see. And
he had a very interesting life.
Yeah. He said, I was peeking around. He said, go up and look. And it just hit me because the next day, it was only a couple paragraphs in the paper. I saw his obituary and I saw his face in the picture. And it just hit me that the crime desk and his family. And I, you know, I walked out there. I saw him. And I just, you know, I think this is it. And I had read a couple of books at that point. That's where the stars aligned for me, that about newsrooms, and that weren't very accurate. Like, they weren't written by reporting people. Connolly was doing a good job back then. And certainly, there were people who were getting it bang on, but there were people who, I thought, well, that's it. I mean, there's the inherent drama in a newsroom. There's the stories. This is what we do. I'm ready to go. So I plotted a novel and worked on it, and that was my first one that got published.
And you've actually interviewed murderers face-to-face.
Yeah.
That must have been very... You must have a lot of interesting stories there.
I went to Death Row, Montana, and interviewed a guy there.
Will that ever play into your future books, any of that stuff?
Oh, yeah. Well, I used that. I used a lot of the stuff from Montana played out in Cold Fear, which was set in Montana.
Ah.
That's my second book. Right. It's a search for a little girl who was lost in the mountains.
Cold Fear,
and it played into some backstory that involved a murderer who was on death row and the family.
Are you fascinated by true crime?
A little bit. I mean, I was more so then because that was my job to be, and to stay in touch with everybody connected to that beat, from the killers, the cops, the people on the street. I must have interviewed so many hookers just to tease my wife, because I'd go out at night and say, oh, I had a hooker in the car last night. And she knew. I mean, they always knew stuff.
I hope so.
Yeah, and I got smacked in the head by one. She knocked my glasses off and cracked them. Like, I came up at the wrong time and asked the wrong question when I shouldn't have. I learned a lesson on that one.
Now, do you have the Jack Gannon series? Do you have an idea for another series if they should ask you to come up with another series?
At this point, no.
Do you have ideas for standalones?
Yeah. Yeah, a couple, and I'm not sure if it's all in one book or several books. There's some ideas that I wanted to go standalone right away, but it just wasn't ready for me, and I discussed it with my agent because I had kind of a seminal idea for it. It just wasn't coming together, so I said it's just not ready, so I got to let that percolate. And then this other one I had was ready to go. It was straight up, and I had the passion for it, and the characters are going to be very strong characters in this one, and... it's a challenge because I'm really... The plot is good and strong. I like that. But this is going to be more character-driven.
Well, is it harder to sell one that's a standalone? Or are you a proven name now? Or what exactly?
Well, I think 6 Seconds, my standalone, probably is my most successful book, actually.
Interesting.
And I got a lot of nice responses on that. Like, a lot of people thought, oh, this puts you on a higher level. We didn't know you were capable of this kind of a story. And so that was all very nice. And... and that was one that I had wanted to do for so long. So that one was just building and building. And when they gave me the green light and I said, I want to do this one, it just came out. That was just the way, and I was quite pleased with that one. And it's still coming out around the world. I know it was published in the UK. It was published in Germany. It was published in 15 countries so far.
That's great.
It might come out a few more. I'm hoping they'll pick the Panic Zone up and Brazil for obvious reasons, but I haven't heard yet.
And also with a series, you never know, it could be picked up for TV, and then you get national exposure. I mean, there's all these things that play into, and, I mean, now they seem to be putting a lot of series on TV,
Well, that would be wonderful. I'm told now the agents that tried to sell my reporter stuff is that Hollywood considers newspapers dead, that it's like they can't sell a newspaper drama or reporter who's a newspaper reporter drama, but there's always an exception to the rule.
Yeah, but they're already looking at Laura Lippman's books for a series.
Yeah.
She's a newspaper reporter, so.
Yeah.
All is not dead yet.
No, I think there's always an exception.
Yeah.
And it's the stories as well, and I know that somebody did a script for a pilot, or I'm not sure it went anywhere. That was way, way back. But I also hope a story like The Panic Zone could stand alone.
Absolutely, yeah.
That, some people got excited and were inquiring about the rights to it, but I don't think that went anywhere yet. But I think that one, it almost serves as a standalone. It could, actually. There's no structure built in that it would have to be connected to
right.
a series, but it is. But what they also do, David, you probably heard from other authors, is that if you have a number of books and they like a certain one, say we want to option that one for a movie, what they do is they option and lock up the character, they license the character.
Hmm.
So in essence, when they buy one book, but they license the character, they've actually got you locked up in control of all your books on that character. So if I have a three-book series and they only like book number two, but they license the character, you can't sell those other books. They own them.
Oh.
And that's just the deal, that you can't get around that or else it's no deal. And I think a lot of authors will write a standalone because it's a separate property. So if I've got my series optioned, and even though I've got three good books on that series, but they've optioned the character and they can do whatever they want with the character out of
those
three books.
That's interesting. I never thought of that.
They can pull pieces of stories and meld them together if they want from there. They can do whatever they want with them, right? But that's like, they know that for the price of one, they get three usually. So agents will try to jack up the price, saying if you're going to license this character, then it's going to cost you this much more. But if you have a standalone, then there's no issue. So, well, okay, I've got this other one. Maybe another movie company will pick up that one. And I'll do another standalone. So the standalone is like having separate houses in terms of an apartment block with a series. You still buy one building, but you get all these units with it, all these stories with it. But if you want to buy a separate house, that's all you're going to get for the option. So
right.
There's a proprietary aspect to it as well.
Well, I can't wait to read the next one, In Desperation, to continue this wonderful character and story. I really am looking forward to it. When I was done this book, I thought, oh, now I can't wait to read the next one. See, that's a good thing, and I'm really looking forward to next April when it comes out.
Well, get me right after Christmas, if you think of it. The arcs will be going out, so send me an email, or go right to...
I'll be over.
go right to Mira. I think they'll do what they did last year. They were offering also free electronic arcs,
right?
As well. So,
mm-hmm.
So I don't. Share
I think they do NetGalley now or something.
I think a lot of people are doing the NetGalley. Yeah, it's quite common now, and they did that with my last two, and a lot of people got it that way. And I was getting reviews. They usually, I think you got to send an email to say this is as opposed to just a reader getting a free book.
Right.
What I do, and I think they pretty much say yes to everybody.
Yeah, I'm always afraid they're going to say that to me. You're just a fan, and that's why you want the books. But I love to interview. I mean, I love doing it.
You probably have gotten books off NetGalley then, right?
I think I got one. I try to get in one. It's a little too complicated getting in. Once you know the system, it's like anything else online. Once you know how to do it, it's okay.
Can you take a NetGalley and load it onto your e-reader if you have one, so it's at least a little more convenient?
Yeah, I don't know. Can you do that? I guess you can do that.
I think it depends on the program and the versatility of your reader.
Right. Exactly. Everything is so, I don't know. We've gotten much more variety. There's so much variety now, but things are becoming more complex in a way, too. So you have to have passwords and all these things. And you got to remember all your passwords, too. So it's a little aggravating. But anyway.
Well, bear it in mind. And if you want, join my newsletter off my homepage, because
right.
I let everybody know on that what's coming. And then that will be a reminder to you. And then if you want, I can arrange to try to get you the old-fashioned arc.
That would be great. You know, I'm an old-fashioned person, too. I love having the book. I mean, holding your book in my hand here now. And that, to me, is the ultimate. E-books will never replace that for me, as much as...
I agree. It's I probably get it for research because of the convenience when you're on a plane and you've got 10 textbooks and you have to peruse them. I think the e-reader may be the way to go. And agents, they use them. That's what they use them for.
Right.
Because they want the manuscripts through PDFs. And when they're traveling and they're looking at clients' work, all they have to do is carry their e-reader around in the bag, which it makes sense
right.
for professional reasons. But they're all diehards, I think. And a lot of readers have told me at conferences, they're finding the e-reader as supplements their passion for reading. That I was at BoucherCon in Indianapolis, and a lady came up. She had my book right on her Kindle,
oh, wow.
showing me, and said, when they're at home, they were like grandmothers. They said, when we travel to see the family and the kids, we take the e-readers on the plane, but at home, we go back and sit in our chair and read our books.
Oh, good for them.
So I said, well, this is actually better then. So it's an expansion rather than an exclusion.
And they can't, and you can't sign the e-reader either. So.
Well, apparently that's going to change now. You know how you can sign the credit card now on the window?
Oh, really?
At some of the checkouts, you can do that digital signing. Apparently they're working on that, where you can maybe sign books. I don't know how we'll do it.
Well, don't they have it all figured out, you know?
Well, they will, yeah.
But this has been,
ultimately.
We have to say goodbye. We're running long on time here, but it's been wonderful to talk to you. And the book, again, is called The Panic Zone. It's out from Mira Books in all your bookstores now, in paperback, and easy to read and cheap. What more can you ask?
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you, Dave.
This has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.